Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Cardiology. This podcast aims to look at the management of dyslipidemias in patients at risk of developing ASCVD. Financial support for this medical educational activity has been provided to Touch IME by an educational grant from Novartis. In this first section, Professor Kaushik Ray and Dr. Mayur Karakas respond to questions and provide their expert insights on the guideline-recommended lipid-lowering targets for patients with dyslipidemias at risk of ASCVD.
Hello and welcome to this Touch in Conversation activity. My name is Dr. Mayur Karakas and I'm a cardiologist at the University Medical Center in Hamburg, Germany. I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Kaushik Ray, who is Professor of Public Health and Primary Care at Imperial College London in the UK. And today we are going to discuss the management of dyslipidemias to improve the outcome of patients with increased risk of ASCVD. In this first section, we are talking on lipid-lowering goals in patients with dyslipidemias and the respective guideline recommendations. First, let's talk on lipids and lipoproteins and their association with elevated ASCVD risk, LDL cholesterol, Lp(a), and triglycerides. LDL-C is the most abundant ApoB-containing lipoprotein, and there's a well-established causal relationship between LDL-C and ASCVD risk, both determined by magnitude and duration of exposure to LDL-C. Regarding Lp(a), it's important to mention that approximately 90% of an individual's concentrations are inherited. And again, Mendelian randomization studies show that lifelong elevated Lp(a) is strongly and causally associated with increased ASCVD risk. Regarding triglycerides, we know that triglyceride-rich ApoB-containing lipoproteins account for most circulating triglycerides, and that high circulating triglycerides are associated with increased ASCVD risk, included statin-treated patients. Now, let's look on the guideline recommendations for lipid and lipoprotein targets. And we're referencing the ESC 2021 and the ESC-AAS 2019 guidelines, which now have adopted much lower LDL-C targets than previously used. It's important to mention that in apparently healthy people, the 10-year fatal and non-fatal cardiovascular risk is estimated using the SCORE 2 system. Patients with documented ASCVD are at a very high risk, that patients with diabetes are at a moderate or higher CV risk, depending on target organ damage, number of risk factors, and diabetes duration. And also important to mention that patients with moderate or severe CKD are at high, very high cardiovascular risk, respectively. There are various LDL-C target levels according to individual risk. So for example, subjects with ASCVD and the second event within 2 years have a much lower LDL-C target level, in this case below 1.0 millimole per liter, than subjects with very high cardiovascular risk, subjects with high cardiovascular risk, with moderate cardiovascular risk, or low cardiovascular risk. And we should also mention that there are no recommended targets for triglycerides or HDL-C in the EAS guidelines, and that Lp(a) should be measured at least once in an individual's lifetime to identify those with a very high inherited risk and levels. Now, Professor Ray, let's look at some questions submitted by our audience that focus on lipid-lowering targets. Question one. Based on experience, I anticipate that it will be difficult to reach the low LDL-C targets from the guidelines of many of my patients. What barriers do you face in achieving these new LDL-C targets in your patients, and what strategies do you use to overcome them?
Thanks, Mahir. I think that's a really important question. And I think the key thing that we have to recognize between the 2016 and the 2019 guidelines is that these new ESC-EAS targets that you showed, they are lower than the levels that we were trying to achieve in 2016. And so whilst we had essentially a statin-based approach only, when we use that approach, a smaller number of patients are going to reach these goals. So the key thing is at an early stage to be thinking about combination therapy. And so with these patients, one of the things I will actually say is explain to them what it is we're trying to achieve. Explain to them for each millimole, we're reducing risk by about 22%. And the aim is to reach the cholesterol level for the level of risk in the individual. And in some people, we may have to do that with the use of combination therapy.
Thank you very much. So question two, do the guidelines provide recommendations on how to avoid undertreating or overtreating patients with dyslipidemias? And the guidelines increasingly lower the optimal LDL-C levels. Is there a minimum level we should not go below?
Yep, and that's another important question from the audience. And one of the key things here is that we start with risk assessment. You will not know what the target is for your patient unless you actually start with assessing the level of risk. So a patient with established cardiovascular disease, by definition, a very high-risk patient. For patients with diabetes, for example, they could be moderate, high, or very high risk. And that assessment then guides your target. So you don't want to undertreat a very high-risk patient. Therefore, those are individuals with lower targets. And you don't want to overtreat a low-risk individual. And the guidelines take into account all of the safety data that we've got from combination therapies, from genetic mutations, where we've achieved LDL levels of below one, and we found that to be safe. So there's no lower LDL that we've found at the moment that is unsafe. And indeed, in those at highest risk, we may recommend LDL goals even below one millimole.
Thank you. So the third question, should we rely solely on LDL-C levels to quantify cardiovascular risk? Or should we look at other components of cholesterol, such as VLDL, ApoB, and Lp(a), as well as TG? Are there any specific patient groups where assessing these would be a priority?
Again, I think this is really an important point for the audience here, because if you look only at lipids or only at LDL cholesterol, you will underestimate risk for your whole population. Because this terminology about dyslipidemia and hypercholesterolemia means that the mindset of many people, many doctors, is to only treat those people with elevated levels of LDL or lipid disorders. And that's not true. So what we are interested in is reducing the risk of cardiovascular disease. So we start with assessment. But within those individuals, there's heterogeneity. There are some people that will have risk-enhancing factors. So if your LPA is high, with that additional information, your absolute risk is higher. And therefore, you might want to treat those people much, much more aggressively. There are individuals with diabetes, for example, with insulin resistance, high triglycerides. And these are people that contain more ApoB-containing lipoproteins, triglyceride-rich lipoproteins, as was said. And cholesterol is carried there alongside the triglycerides. So for those people, we should be thinking about non-HDL and ApoB for the level of risk that was identified to really adequately treat these people. Because if you only use LDL cholesterol, what you're going to be doing is underestimating risk and therefore under-treating.
Thank you very much. And the final question on the section, I have a 64-year-old male patient who had a stroke 18 months ago and recently had a second stroke. He's receiving atorvastatin 80 milligrams once daily, and his LDL-C at last visit was 1.8 millimole per liter. What is the appropriate LDL-C target for this patient?
So this is a classic example of somebody that we would have accepted an LDL of 1.8 in 2016, but on the basis of the first stroke event itself, we would now want an LDL of 1.4. And that recent history with the recurrent stroke event within a couple of years would mean that the appropriate level of LDL for this patient by 2019 guidelines is an LDL below one millimole. So you can see they're already on atorvastatin 80. So we're going to have to use some form of combination therapy to achieve at least an additional 0.8 millimole reduction in LDL to get below one millimole.
Thank you, Professor Ray, for this important discussion on lipid-lowering goals in patients with dyslipidemia, considering the latest guidelines.
In this second section, Professor Kaushik Ray and Dr. Mayur Karakas respond to questions on the selection of appropriate lipid and lipoprotein therapies using the latest guidelines and clinical data, as well as the emerging treatment landscape for patients with dyslipidemias.
In the second section, we consider strategies to reduce ASCVD risk. We want to understand the latest guidelines and clinical data on lipid-lowering therapies. Regarding the pharmacological management of dyslipidemias, the current guidelines recommend that, alongside dietary and lifestyle modifications, a stepwise treatment intensification approach is used to control LDL-C. For treatment of LDL-C lowering, guidelines recommend high-intensity statin, ezetimibe, PCSK9 inhibitors, and by the combination of these drugs and compounds results in various different average LDL-C reductions. The treatment algorithm for pharmacological LDL-C lowering according to guidelines starts with the total cardiovascular risk assessment and the determination of baseline LDL-C levels. Once there is an indication for the patient for drug therapy, we have to define the treatment goal and first use a high-potency statin at the highest recommended or tolerable dose to reach this goal. And if this goal is not reached, we can add ezetimibe, and in the next step may even add or consider adding a PCSK9 inhibitor. It's important to say that there are new drugs in the treatment landscape. Just in 2020, EMA approved bempedoic acid and inclisiran, and in 2021, the EMA approved icosapent-ethyl. The indication for bempedoic acid and inclisiran is primary hypercholesterolemia or mixed dyslipidemia in combination with a statin or alone, and in a combination for patients who cannot have a statin. The indication for icosapent-ethyl is the reduction of cardiovascular events in adults, statin-treated patients with triglycerides at a level of at least 1.0 millimole per liter, and established cardiovascular disease or diabetes, and at least one cardiovascular risk factor. We should also mention there are some new investigational emerging compounds like pelacarsen, pemafibrat, opiketrapib, VERV-101, which use different modes of actions to reduce risk, cardiovascular risk in this set of patients. Now, Professor Ray, let's look at some questions submitted by our audience that focus on lipid-lowering therapies and the clinical evidence and guidelines supporting them. Question 1. The European guidelines recommend a treatment intensification approach, starting with a statin monotherapy. Based on your clinical experience, what proportion of my patients would be able to reach their new, low LDL-C targets without the use of a combination therapy? And second, what combinations are possible in those who don't reach the target?
So thank you. I think we're slowly seeing that people are understanding that when you're aiming for an LDL cholesterol of below 1.4 for very high-risk patients, that even when you optimize high-intensity statin therapy, you're actually only going to get 20%, one in five patients to goal. So you've really got to add in ezetimibe according to the next step. And when you add in ezetimibe to a high-intensity statin, now, based on published data like Da Vinci, we know that about another one in five will get to goal. So you're getting 40, 45, even up to 50% to goal with these two drugs. So that means for the third group, the 50%, the vast majority, your options are either to use a PCSK9-directed therapy, and that could be a monoclonal, or that could be inclisiran, or potentially to use a third oral agent like bempedoic acid. And with these different approaches, you are now either getting 60, 65, or even 80% or more of your patients to goal.
Thank you very much. So question 2. In the absence of guideline recommendations for the recently approved agents bempedoic acid and inclisiran, which of my patients with dyslipidemias may benefit the most of these treatment options? And the second question, can they be combined with other lipid-lowering therapies? And are there any long-term efficacy and safety data available?
So again, with the guidelines that came out, we then had the approval of these two agents right after the 2019 guidelines. But they were actually already acknowledged as emerging therapies because their approval was already expected. So we don't yet have cardiovascular outcome trial data for those, but they are available in countries for additional LDL lowering. And I think what I would say is that for those patients that don't get to goal with a starting level of statins and ezetimibe, they clearly have a role to play. So for your patients, not at goal despite. The one caveat is that bempedoic acid works through the same pathway as statins. So the amount of additional lowering that you get depends upon the background statin therapy being used. So moderate or high intensity, you're only getting additional 18% further lowering. So if appropriate and available, then a newer treatment like inclisiran, which will give you over 50% lowering, would be advantageous. On a background of no or low dose statin, you're getting about 28% further lowering. And clearly, bempedoic acid is approved also for statin intolerant patients. So somebody that's not on any statins per se, you could use a combination of bempedoic acid and ezetimibe, achieve a 38% lowering, see if you're at goal. If you're not at goal, then you need to think about a PCSK9 directed therapy. And you've got options for switching the ordering of some of these as well. And to the point about safety data, we have got, with the bempedoic acid trials, open label extension data. I led the CLEAR Harmony trial, and basically we have open label extension data now for at least another year after that. And these are smaller molecules. The effect stops as soon as you stop the medication. So we've got good safety data. We have similar data for inclisiran as well. You were involved with Orion 1, the phase 1 study, and we had an open label extension for another 4 years of those patients. And what we found with repeated dosing, at least to date, is that there is no difference in any adverse events or safety profile that we didn't see in the original randomized trial period against placebo. So we have good safety data for both.
Thank you very much.
So question 3, I am treating my 46-year-old male patient who has type 2 diabetes and hypercholesterolemia with rosuvastatin, 40 milligrams once daily, and ezetimibe, 10 milligrams once daily, alongside lifestyle advice and counseling on adherence. But after 6 months, he has not reached his LDL-C target of below 1.8 millimol per liter. I am now planning to add a PCSK9 inhibitor. What do I need to consider in terms of side effect monitoring for this three drug combination?
Yeah, this is a common issue that we face in clinical practice, what to do about these patients. And the first thing to actually check is that the patient is adherent to medication, because that many of these patients won't be, and maybe they will be at goal if they're adherent. But essentially, the next thing to think about is if both treatment options are available. We have two different types of PCSK9 directed therapies. One is a self-injection every 2 weeks, and the other is a siRNA-based therapy, which will basically be injected on day 1, day 90, and then 6 monthly thereafter. So you'd look at availability of the treatments, you'd look at patient preference, and in terms of safety profile, there's really no difference. We don't have head-to-head trials, but within the individual trial program, we've really not seen anything. And there may be some patients, for example, who are a little bit older, feel a little bit less comfortable about doing auto-injectors. So now the advantage of coming in practically to a healthcare professional, like an outpatient clinic, having a subcutaneous injection, 1.5 mils, and then going home, may be a really a convenient way to move forward for those patients.
Thank you.
And the fourth question, what can you tell us about investigational agents for managing dyslipidemias? What do they target and how might they benefit my patients beyond the current treatment options?
So all of our treatment therapies target LDL-C lowering and as such target non-HDL and ApoB specifically. But we know in people with a high triglyceride, and we know in people with a high LPA, there's a high residual risk that you can't overcome simply through LDL reduction. So LDL lowering is first line therapy. Now, of the investigational therapies, pemafibrate was the newest of the so-called SPARM, a selective PPAR agonist that's been tested. We know that the large outcome trial has been stopped because of futility, but with no adverse warnings regarding safety. So that hasn't been published yet. We know that for the LPA lowering therapies, for example, these are injectable therapies that either target the messenger RNA using an antisense oligonucleotide, so monthly injection, and potentially with siRNA-based therapies in the future with 6 monthly injections. Now, they will lower lipoprotein A by about over 90%. We don't have any treatments that can target those pathways, but they have to show cardiovascular event reduction, because Whereas we know for LDL lowering, it doesn't matter how you lower LDL cholesterol, that you will reduce clinical events. And so that basically leaves us to the CETP inhibitor, obicetrapib. And this is now being tested in cardiovascular outcome trial. Interestingly, as an LDL-lowering therapy, we might, with a third agent, be able to achieve a 50% further reduction in LDL cholesterol. And we used to think about these drugs as HDL-raising, but essentially it seems to me that these, not seems to me, but essentially the data suggests that the benefit is exactly proportional to the absolute lowering of LDL cholesterol. So that is going to be investigated as an additional LDL-lowering therapy.
Thank you, Professor Ray, for this important discussion on lipid-lowering treatments and the respective clinical evidence supporting these.
In this final section, Professor Kaushik Ray and Dr. Mayur Karakas respond to questions on the management of dyslipidemias in special patient populations, including patients with diabetes or with chronic kidney disease and older patients.
In this final section, we are asking for the important considerations regarding the management of dyslipidemias in special patient populations. And the guidelines discuss the management of dyslipidemias in older patients, in subjects with diabetes, with chronic kidney disease, and those with familial hypercholesterolemia, or shortly FH. Regarding older patients, the current guidelines revised the definition of older age as of at least 70 years. And their statin therapy for primary prevention in these subjects may be considered in high-risk patients. Regarding diabetes, very high risk is defined as target organ damage, as existence of at least 3 risk factors, or the early onset of type 1 diabetes with a duration of at least 20 years. Regarding chronic kidney disease, very high risk is defined as existence of severe kidney disease, defined by an eGFR below 30 milliliters per minute. And in FH, very high risk is defined as existence of FH with ASCVD or with another major risk factor. And it's important that in these patient groups with very high risk, the LDL target is below 1.4 millimole per liter, and a reduction of at least 50% from baseline. Now, Professor Ray, let's look at some questions submitted by our audience that focus on the important considerations for managing dyslipidemias in special patient populations. Question 1. What are some of the important considerations in terms of treatment goals and suitability of therapies when managing older patients? And how do you deal with the challenges involved in managing older patients, especially those of very advanced age?
So again, another challenge that we face in common clinical practice. I think the first thing, I mean, compared to 20 years ago, that I start with all of my patients, some of the comments from patients of all age groups is, does this mean I have to take statins for life? They don't ask about any other treatments, it's always statins. And what I always say to them is that the treatments, you can stop them at any stage if you get side effects. We can manage those by switching statins, reducing a lower dose, different regimens. So the benefits will occur while you take the medications. But should you develop side effects, then we have other options that we can use. So that's to get their confidence. Older patients will often be on polypharmacy. There'll be on multi-drug combinations. And we need to think about drug-drug interactions. We also need to think about adherence as a result of this. So having done all of this, we still manage them in the same way in terms of the goals and the targets, but we have to consider all of these things and life expectancy. So if somebody's got end-stage heart failure, for example, if they've got end-stage renal disease or a condition which basically means their life expectancy is really short, well, there's not much point in managing their lipids if the life expectancy is 6 months, for example. So, but we manage them in very much a similar way, but consider comorbidities, frailties, convenience, adherence, but the targets are still the same.
Thank you very much.
So question 2, how can I reduce the risk of stroke, myocardial infarction, in my patients with type 2 diabetes and nephropathy?
Well, by definition, a patient with type 2 diabetes and nephropathy has end organ damage. They're going to have really very high risk of cardiovascular disease. For LDL targets, for example, this is a very high risk patient, and we would want to get their LDL down below 1.4. And often these patients have high triglycerides, so their non-HDL should be below 2.2, for example, or ApoB below 65. So it's important that we consider lipid lowering, but also we've got to think about blood pressure lowering. The patients with diabetes and nephropathy may well get progression of disease. So these are people that should have adequate blood pressure control, achieving at least blood pressures below 135, 85, but ideally probably more like 130, 80. And again, we now have treatments that actually reduce the progression of disease, the SGLT2 inhibitors, for example. So again, trying to protect these patients holistically, not just focusing on lipids, but a global approach.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Question 3. Do the guidelines say anything about prevention of ASCVD or the management of ASCVD risk in children? And I'm specifically thinking about my pediatric patients with FH or with obesity.
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is separate FH from obesity, because the lipid abnormalities are very different. So the first thing to say is that FH, heterozygous FH, occurs in 1 in 311 of the global population. And it results in high lifelong exposure of LDL from birth. And these people present with premature cardiovascular disease, often in their 40s or 50s. So again, very early on. So the key here is detection and screening. And this is where much of Europe and much of the world is trying to move towards. Now, if we find these children early for heterozygous FH, the short-term risk of cardiovascular disease is going to be low. So you're investing long-term in LDL control. And we can start treating these patients with statins, statins, and ezetimibe, from example, the age of 8. Now, the one difference is homozygous FH, because these are people, instead of having an LDL of 4, 5, or 6, may have LDLs higher than 10. And these are people we know that often have ASCVD in the first decade of life. So from the point of diagnosis, we treat these children very aggressively with combination therapy, statins, ezetimibe, and often apheresis. That's the only way to try and reduce blood levels to protect the risk of cardiovascular disease. Now, for the person with obesity, the child with obesity, we're not thinking about medication. We're thinking about the cause of the lipid disorders that will occur later on. The high TG, the higher triglyceride-rich lipoproteins, low HDL, and starting that prevention early means diet, lifestyle, weight loss. There may be certain metabolic disorders that a pediatric physician may look at, and there are certain inherited disorders that go with obesity. So you've got to do a little bit more work there before thinking about simply diet or lifestyle, but the approach is very different.
Thank you.
And the final question in this section, for patients who cannot tolerate statin therapy, what are the options for second-line therapies to achieve the LDL-C targets with few side effects?
Well, statins are obviously first line. They're the cheapest drugs, and they've been available for over 20 odd years. Nature doesn't care how you lower LDL cholesterol. And we know that 1 millimole lowering by any approach reduces cardiovascular disease risk, at least through 4 different mechanisms today, by about 22%. So for these patients, you still are aiming for the same target. So you've got to immediately start thinking about combination therapies and probably PCSK9 directed therapies earlier. So with that in mind, I would look at what is available and approved in my country and in my region. I would want to go to the most potent treatment options, which usually means either thinking about a monoclonal or inclisiran, for example, but also bempedoic acid in combination with ezetimibe to achieve a 38% lowering, whereas the other two PCSK9-directed approaches would give me essentially about 50 to 60% lowering, depending upon the approach. All of these approaches have been very well tested with few side effects compared to placebo. With bempedoic acid, the only issue that you have in about 1% of patients is gout, but that can be reversed by stopping the medication. And with any injectable therapy, about 1% of patients may experience an injection site reaction at the injection site, which basically is mild or moderate in severity, but is transient and usually just goes away by itself. So these treatments are remarkable. They are good, and it's great for us to have all of these options.
Thank you, Professor Ray, for your very interesting insights into the monitoring and management of lipoproteins to reduce the risk of ASCVD. And I would also like to thank the audience for participating in this educational activity. I hope you enjoyed the session and found the insights offered here useful for further developing your clinical practice.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic on Touch Cardiology at www.touchcardiology.com.